Today is Wednesday, April the 9th, 2025. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how big tech companies and our government are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a three-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to Hank at pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.live, that's PRN.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your questions or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Say goodbye to the Google Assistant. Gemini is moving in. Gemini replacing Google Assistant. Say goodbye to the Google Assistant. It's all Gemini now. All the time. Google announced that the Google Assistant is no longer for this world. The company plans to transition most Android devices to Gemini instead. This includes phones, tablets, devices that connect to your phone, headphones, and even the assistant in the car. The only devices spared would be those limited to 2 gigabytes of RAM or that aren't on a compatible version of Android. Gemini is a better digital assistant in many ways. It is much more conversational, and you can use it with yourself to talk out thoughts and whatnot. Google is in the process of replacing Google Assistant with its new AI platform, Gemini. This transition is expected to occur gradually, with users on mobile devices seeing the change over the coming months, and a full rollout anticipated later in 2025. Gemini is designed to offer more advanced capabilities compared to Google Assistant. It aims to enhance user interaction through features like Gemini Live and Deep Research, which provides new ways to access information and assistance. To prepare for the switch, users will need to ensure that Google Assistant is set as the default assistive app on their devices. This can be done by navigating to Settings, Apps, Default Apps on Android devices. The transition has sparked discussions within the Google community, with users expressing mixed feelings about the change. Some are concerned about the implication of losing Google Assistant, which has been a staple digital assistant for many. While Gemini is set to replace Google Assistant, it promises to bring enhanced features and capabilities, marking a significant shift on how users interact with Google's AI technologies. Google Assistant and even Apple Siri are undergoing the next evolution. Digital assistants were always supposed to be more conversational, personal, and interactive. And now that Gemini has achieved it, Google is ready to roll it out. Apple iPhone owners are urged to download new update now as a security must. The new iPhone software update, iOS 18.4, could be more critical than is being talked about when it comes to security. While there are lots of new features added in the latest version, what's less talked about is the 62 security updates and fixes that came with this version. Some are quite serious. Apple doesn't make a big deal about these fixes, as the plan is to keep them under the radar to stop attackers finding vulnerabilities or knowing when doors are closed to their attacks. Ultimately, it's a choice to help protect iPhone owners for as long as possible from the update rolling out. Looking more closely at the iOS 18.4 update reveals there were some serious flaws that could leave current older software users at risk. Some of the patches were found in WebKit for Safari, and the kernel at the heart of the iPhone operating system. The fixes stops the possibility of a malicious app being able to attempt passcode entries on a locked device. On websites, there was a chance that a cross-site scripting attack could leave users vulnerable. This would allow attackers to inject malicious scripts right from trusted websites. While updates to iOS 18.4 now, well, since all these patches are now publicly available, it means attackers can see, even more clearly, the vulnerabilities in older versions. These are likely the devices that will be attacked now. Since Apple has fixed more than 60 issues in one update, that means this is a big security shift, showing just how vulnerable older versions may be. If you have an iPhone, that's the iPhone X's or newer than this update applies to you, or newer, then this update applies to you and is available now. To upgrade your software, simply navigate to your settings menu, then select the general tab, and then software update. This will give you the option to download and install iOS 18.4 update with a restart to let everything take effect. Then open up like you're starting your brand new shiny iPhone. Microsoft is retiring Skype on May the 5th, 2025. The following is a press release from Microsoft. They start off with, "Dear Skype user, in order to streamline our free consumer communications offering, we will be retiring Skype on May the 5th, 2025 to focus on Microsoft Teams, our modern communications and collaboration hub. Teams helps people stay connected and engage at work and at home. Teams users have access to many of the same core features as Skype, including one-to-one calls, group calls, messaging, and file sharing. Additionally, Teams offers enhanced features like host meetings, managing calendars, and building and joining communities, all for free. And here's what this means for you. You can transition to Microsoft Teams for free, starting today. You can log into Microsoft Teams free on any supported device using your Skype credentials, and your contacts and chats will automatically be transferred. You will also receive a notification in the Skype app over the coming days prompting you to take action. Moving to Teams is simple, and it doesn't prevent you from continuing to use Skype during the transition period. We are no longer offering paid Skype features to new customers, including Skype credit and subscriptions that allow you to make and receive international and domestic calls. Existing calling and Skype number subscriptions will continue to be automatically renewed until this past April 3rd of this year, and after May 2025, those with active Skype credits and subscriptions can continue to enjoy these paid features and use the Skype dial pad from the Skype web portal and within Teams free. To transfer your Skype number, contact your new carrier. In addition, Skype minutes will be removed from Microsoft 365 personal and Microsoft 365 family subscriptions benefits beginning in March 2026. Thank you for being part of Skype. We want to express our deepest gratitude for your support over the years. Skype has been an integral part of countless meaningful moments, and we are honored to have been part of your journey. We understand that change can be challenging, and we are here to support you during this transition. We've prepared a step-by-step guide and FAQ to help you get started. As we take this next step with Teams, we look forward to continuing to support your everyday connection in new and meaningful ways. With gratitude, the Skype team. Microsoft is replacing its remote desktop app with Windows app to access your PC remotely. You'll find the same functionality in its new Windows app as in the remote desktop app. The remote desktop app for Windows is almost dead. Long live the Windows app. Microsoft said that its legacy remote desktop client, which has already been replaced on other platforms, will no longer be supported on Windows after May the 27th, 2025. But you aren't losing any functionality here. You can still do tech support for your parents using built-in Windows functionality, or the modern Windows app, which is somehow both the simplest and most confusing name convention Microsoft's marketing team could have mustered. Starting May 27, 2025, the remote desktop app for Windows from the Microsoft Store will no longer be supported or available for download and installation. Microsoft's Hillary Braun wrote on its Windows IT Pro blog, "Users must transition to Windows app to ensure continued access to Windows 365, Azure, Virtual Desktop, and Microsoft DevBox." The company says connection to Windows 365, Azure, Virtual Desktop, and Microsoft DevBox, the remote desktop app from the Microsoft Store, will be blocked in the remote desktop app on the app's expiration date on May the 27th. For all other users, it will continue working, but will no longer be supported. Increasing the confusion, Windows has a built-in remote desktop connection app that will remain the only way to use remote desktop protocol RDP connections after May 27th, but Microsoft will eventually incorporate that into the Windows app. Microsoft warned that it would eventually replace the remote desktop with the Windows app when the operating system's namesake app launched last fall. The new app even arrived as an update to the remote desktop client on the Apple's App Store. The new app is interestingly named Windows App. The company likely chose that branding because it wants to move Windows increasingly to the cloud. Its Windows 365 service, introduced in 2021, even lets you stream a virtual version of the operating system from any device. So calling the unified app used to access cloud and remote PCs, Windows App, seems maybe slightly less bizarre from that angle. Microsoft wants you to access its desktop operating system from anywhere. You can use the Windows app to access your PC remotely or in the cloud. There's more than one way to use Windows now, as well as sitting down in front of a locally installed copy of Windows, running on a hard drive inside your desktop or laptop. You can also fire up the Microsoft Windows app, a one-stop central hub for managing connections to remote PCs and Windows in the cloud. The Windows app is available for Windows, as you would expect, as well as macOS, iOS, iPadOS, and, in preview form for now, Android. It was first rolled out in September of 2024. The program brings with it support for multiple monitors and local USB peripherals so you can carry on using your own webcam, for example, with your cloud copy of Windows. It's likely that significantly more people are going to get acquainted with the Windows app over the next few months. Microsoft has announced that the remote desktop app on the Microsoft Store, so not the standalone MSI installer, is being pulled in May, and that users should switch to using the Windows app instead. For the time being at least, you'll need a work or school Microsoft account to use the Windows app as yet. Microsoft hasn't said anything about individual consumer getting access. If you fit the eligibility criteria, the Windows app and the various features will give you access. The Windows app interface is pretty straightforward and is basically just a minimal-looking portal to Windows machines you're connecting to remotely or streaming from the cloud. There's also a section for remotely hosted apps that your place of work or school has given you access to. If you're in an IT department of some description, you may well have many of these devices and apps to manage and connect to, and there are simple tools for sifting through the various icons and thumbnails. You can mark certain devices and apps as favorites, for example, which puts them in a separate section. Workspaces can be expanded or collapsed, shown as a list or as a grid, and filtered in various ways so you can keep the Windows installations you last connected to near the top of the screen, for example, put them in alphabetic order, or arrange them manually in any way you see fit. Once you're connected to another Windows machine, it's very much like using a local installation. The Windows app takes care of the necessary syncing with input devices, and you're able to customize the connection in a variety of ways. Which screen resolution the remote Windows app shows up, for examples. As well as the aforementioned USB peripheral and multi-monitor support, you can also set up audio and video streaming, redirect folders, configure universal clipboard access to make it more straightforward to transfer files and data between your local device and the remote one. Connections can be established via a couple of clicks or taps. The Windows app is able to access other Windows PC remotely as long as they're running Windows Professional, Windows Enterprise, or Windows Server. If you're not gathered by now, this isn't currently aimed at casual Windows Home users. Some setup is required on the computer you're connecting to, in part to prevent you from logging into the machines of complete strangers. This setup process gives you the detail you need to connect from the other end, and it gives you a handy way of connecting to your office PC while you're at home or vice versa. The Windows app also supports Windows 365, where you are essentially streaming a Windows PC over web. Again, this is mostly aimed at businesses and education institutions, with pricing starting at $31 per user per month, and there's no indication yet that consumers will be able to rent their own cloud-based Windows PC anytime soon. There are some other connection options of interest to IT professionals, including Azure, Virtual Desktop, and Microsoft DevBox. So it's a comprehensive tool for getting at Windows from anywhere. The reviews of the Microsoft Store version suggest it's far from bug-free, and there are some known limitations. But a lot of the negative reviews are simply complaints about the software only being for work and school accounts. With the connections made, you're then able to access features like secondary monitor support. This even works on mobile devices, potentially giving you an easier way to run Windows from a phone or tablet. These mobile devices can run the app in both portrait and landscape mode as well, and dynamically switch between them. Well, if you happen to be a Windows Home user, you could do what I do. I use AnyDesk. There is a free version that allows you to do everything that Windows app allows you to do, plus more. For instance, you're able to run an Android app from your Windows PC, which is not possible with Windows app because all the traffic goes into a Windows PC for the processing. TSA confirms what electronic devices goes in your carry-on luggage. Packing is becoming more and more complicated. What can I bring? Can I bring liquids? What if I need to bring my laptop? Can I put it in the hold? If you are planning to travel soon, the TSA, that's the Transportation Security Administration, has banned certain devices from being carried in checked luggage because they are a serious risk of fire. We are going to tell you everything we know about these new developments so that packing your suitcase is not a very complicated task. But for now, there is something you should know, and that is all your electronic devices that have lithium batteries will have to go in your carry-on luggage. You cannot put it in the hold. An incident that occurred in 2010 highlighted the lack of safety regarding lithium batteries. Apparently, a Boeing 747 UPS Flight 6 was carrying a large number of batteries. This aircraft crashed after suffering a fire in the cargo hold. Why? Because the batteries had caught fire due to the change in pressure and had exploded. This obviously led the authorities to establish new regulations that would also adapt to the technologies in order to avoid tragedies similar to this one. What items are prohibited in checked luggage? As was mentioned, there are certain products that are dangerous to transport at high pressures, and that is why you will have to take them with you. And here are the list. Number 1, external batteries, such as power banks. Spare batteries for cameras or computers are totally prohibited in checked luggage, basically because lithium can suddenly heat up due to shocks or rapid changes in temperature, so if you need to carry one of these, you will also have to carry it in your hand luggage, and if possible, inside a protective case. Note that there are specific restrictions. Batteries of up to 100 watt-hours can travel without prior notification. but if they exceed the voltage approval from the airline, approval from the airline will be required and only two can be carried per passenger. Second, mobile phones and tablets. Although they may seem harmless, it is important to remember that any device that has a battery can represent a danger. Since there is nothing safe about these devices, it is best to always carry them with you, so that if they overheat for any reason, the crew can intervene as quickly as possible to mitigate the possible effects. It may seem like a small thing, but a typical flight usually carries around 200 passengers, and normally, each one carries their own mobile phone. If a few of them put their mobile phones in the hold, we will be talking about how many? 25 or 50 devices without supervision, making it very difficult to intervene in time if one of these devices suffer a problem. Number 3. Laptops with mobile phones. They have even larger batteries than a phone, which further increases the risk of fire. In 2023, United Airlines experienced a fire caused by a laptop in a cabin, and although the situation was resolved fairly quickly, the incident made it clear that great care must be taken and that these devices must be completely turned off during takeoff and landing. Fourth, electronic cigarettes are also prohibited according to the Federal Aviation Administration, that's the FAA, which considers that these devices could also overheat, so it requires deactivating the devices and removing the batteries during the flight to prevent them from being accidentally turned on. Remember, also, that smoking is prohibited on airplanes. Number 5. You also have to be careful with portable video game consoles and take them with you, but not with home ones. So if you want to travel with your PlayStation 5, you can take it in the hold because they don't have internal batteries. They run on alternating current. But our most personal advice is take it with you, as your luggage can get lost or stolen and you would lose your console. If you have any doubts about what devices you can carry in your luggage, always check the rules of the airline you're traveling with to avoid unpleasant surprises and to avoid putting anyone in danger. Have a good trip! VPNs owned by Chinese companies on the Apple App Store and the Google Play Store. Recent investigations have revealed that several VPN apps available on the Apple App Store and Google Play Store are owned by Chinese companies, some of which have ties to the entities sanctioned by the U.S. government or linked to the Chinese military. China's data laws can force companies to share user data with the government, meaning Chinese authorities could access the internet traffic of a significant number of Americans. The ownership of these apps is deliberately opaque, as they are hidden behind layers of offshore shell companies and none clearly disclose their Chinese ownership. The research was carried out by the Tech Transparency Project, that's TPP, with additional work carried out by the Financial Times. The latter reportedly notified Apple of its findings. These apps are popular among U.S. users and have been downloaded millions of times. They are TurboVPN, VPN Proxy Master, ThunderVPN, SnapVP, and Signal Secure VPN. By the way, Signal Secure VPN has no relationship to the encrypted messaging app Signal. Chinese companies offering free VPNs include Qino 360, that's Qihoo. At least 5 free VPN apps were traced back to a firm known as Qino 360. The company has previously been listed as a Chinese military company and was sanctioned by the U.S. Commerce Department in June of 2020 on national security grounds. Then there's Free Connected Limited. This company is listed in Hong Kong's corporate ministry, is owned by Chengdu Zhenghao Technology Company Limited, a Chinese tech firm. Innovating Connecting is a Chinese company secretly owned 10 VPN products, which collectively have 86 million in stores. These apps are marketed as independent, but are under the same ownership. They own TurboVPN, which is a widely used app, and has been flagged for its ties to Chinese entities. It even obtained Google's verified baggage, which is meant to signify trustworthiness, which it is not. The ties of these VPNs from Chinese companies particularly those with military links, raise concerns about user data privacy and potential surveillance. If you're considering using a VPN, it's essential to research its ownership and privacy policies to ensure that your data is really secure. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and a lot of what's going on. And I'm in the middle of this series. This is the fourth one in the series in regards to the whole idea that we need to return to office. A lot of us have been working via remote for 5 years. We came across this through COVID, and IT enabled us to do remote work, become digital nomads, and to really start working with people in other countries and build teams that are scattered across, not just across the city, across the state, but across the country and around the world. And that's all because of technology. This is something we couldn't do a matter of 30 years ago. But now we've got the ability to do that. And I will tell you that, yes, there are employers that are throwing different ideas out that say we need to go back into the office. One of the ones that I heard that doesn't really ring true to me, especially since I've been a part of security, and it says that security requires office work. I'll tell you, I worked for an aerospace subcontractor, and we had a lot of security concerns, and we would try to address them on a regular basis. I had one particular worker who could not remember his password, a very simple password, a very easy password. So what did he do? He put his password on a post-it note. And he would hide it around after a little while, after I continued to just get on his case. But it still was a matter, if you sat at his desk for more than 3 minutes, you were going to find that post-it note. Yes, it was under his keyboard. It was on the back side of his monitor. It was underneath his phone. And he moved the location every once in a while. Usually when I said, "Hey, I found your post-it note," security is one of those things that they talk about, but the reality is security, you're not going to have a whole lot of control over security without changing what people are doing. It's not a matter of bringing them all into the office. That's a horrible idea. You're not going to beat security by bringing them all into the office and then forgetting to train them without, you have to sit them down. You have to show them how to be better with security. And that can be done. I'll tell you, I've worked at a few different companies now where all of my security training took place, not in person, but by sitting and watching a video. And it told me, for me, it told me a bunch of things I already know. Don't put your password on post-it notes. Don't share information with people who aren't supposed to have that information. And things like that. Even still, it was probably really basic security learnings. Over the course of the last, 10 different videos I've seen on this, because, you know, you get refresher videos and stuff like that, I didn't learn anything new. And nothing new came out of them. And that's partially from where I'm at, but it's also partially from the idea that we're still not building security as a culture, as a concept in the minds of people. We still have people who post on Facebook all kinds of different personal, private things that they really should never have posted. So I'll tell you, security concerns, they don't require being in the office. And I'll tell you, if you are concerned about security, about the security of your data and all of the different information that's on your servers, and you're concerned that the person who's working remote may be able to steal that information or share it or somehow break down your security protocols, I'll tell you something. It's not about their location, because they'll hide it just as much in the office as they would via remote. They're still going to do it. You need to figure out the person, not the location. The next item on my list here is the idea that onboarding needs to be in person. And I struggle with this one because I've gone into companies where the whole onboarding process was, here's a bunch of paperwork, fill it out. Okay, you're onboarded. Okay, maybe a little bit more than that. You spend a matter of a few hours talking to someone who says, this is how we do this particular project. This is how we do this particular set of operational tasks. This is what we do here. This is what we do there. And you're onboarded. In many cases, onboarding is just trial by fire. And it doesn't matter whether you're in the office or not. If everybody has to be in the office to be onboarded, Then do that, but then don't require them to be onboarded and then in the office and then just make them stay in the office because the onboarding is over. It's all done with. If your company is relying upon the new workers getting their information because they're sitting next to someone rather than through some level of structured training, that is not a work problem. That is a problem with the company, the training, or perhaps those who are being trained. And those are the areas which you improve upon. Like, there's so many different things, and I could go for weeks on end. And I'm going to wrap this up right now because I've got a number of different lists here. I've got multiple people who've reached out to me through the radio show here, and they've said, hey, have you thought about this? What do you think about that? And I'll tell you, I could go on for a long time, but I want to wrap it up with this. The idea of returning to office for some may be good. For some out there, it's going to be a must-have. But for a lot of people who can be productive, who can be more productive – in their own home, in their own home office, the whole idea of making everybody across the board return to office as a mandate doesn't make as much sense to me and probably doesn't make a whole lot of sense to a lot of people out there. We need to be thinking about this all the way along, together, as teams, as partners in the company. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. The impact of tariffs on electronics equipment. Tariffs, which are taxes imposed on imported goods, can significantly affect the cost of electronics equipment, including popular items like iPhones. The extent of the impact depends on various factors, including the tariff rate, the country of origin for components, and the strategies employed by companies to manage these additional costs. How do tariffs affect retail prices? Tariffs are calculated based on the value of goods, including freight and insurance, at the time they enter the country. For example, if a 54% tariff were applied to an iPhone imported from China, the declared value of the iPhone, not its retail price, would be subject to this tax. Retailers and manufacturers have several options for dealing with increased costs due to tariffs. Companies may choose to absorb the tariff costs, which would protect consumers from price increases but reduce profit margins. Alternatively, companies might increase retail prices to maintain profit margins, potentially leading to reduced sales. A combination of absorbing some costs and passing others to consumers is also common, balancing profit margins and customer retention. Companies may explore alternative sourcing options, such as shifting production to countries with more favorable trade agreements to reduce reliance on high tariff regions like China. Will an iPhone become 54% more expensive? While some media outlets have speculated that a 54% tariff could lead to a corresponding increase in retail prices, this is unlikely. The tariff applies to the declared value of the product upon import, not its final retail price. Additionally, companies like Apple may absorb some costs or find efficiencies in their supply chain to mitigate the impact. For instance, Apple's profit margin on iPhone is estimated to be around 30%. This means that for every dollar of revenue generated from iPhone sales, Apple retains approximately 30 cents as profit. In terms of specific models, for instance, the iPhone 14 Pro Max costs Apple about $501 to manufacture, while it is sold at a base price of $1,099, resulting in a markup of about 119%. The production of an iPhone involves a global supply chain with a significant portion of its components sourced from foreign countries. Estimates suggest that 90% or more of the iPhone production costs are attributed to foreign expenses, including components and assembly, while only a small percentage, around 10%, is domestic, primarily related to design, software development, and marketing in the United States. The iPhone 14 Pro Max costs Apple about $501 to manufacture, which breaks out to $450 foreign expense and $51 domestic expense. The 54% tariff on $450 works out to $243. If the tariff expense is passed on to the consumer, the increase in cost would be $243, or 22%, not 54%. And, of course, the manufacturer does not necessarily have to pass the entire increase on to the consumer. The original profit of $598 for an item that's $1,099 is not shabby at all. The assembly of iPhones is predominantly done in China, and many components such as chips, screens, and batteries are sourced from countries like South Korea, Japan, and Taiwan. Apple's headquarters in the United States handles design, software, and marketing, which accounts for a smaller share of the overall cost. Overall, Apple's gross profit margin has been reported to be as high as 43.88% as of late 2024, indicating strong profitability across its product lines, including the iPhone. If Apple imports 256-gigabyte iPhone 16 Pro from China, the tariff would apply to its import value, not the retail price. This means the final price increase for consumers would likely to be less than 54%, depending on Apple's pricing strategy. Broader implications of tariffs on electronics can lead to higher prices to a wide range of products, from smartphones to appliances. For example, a $40 toaster oven might cost $48 to $52 after tariffs, illustrating how small increases can affect affordability. Higher tariffs can reduce the competitiveness of American business and increase inflation as consumers face higher prices across various sectors. The unpredictability of tariff policies creates challenges for businesses reliant on global supply chains. This uncertainty can lead to market instability and long-term shifts in trade practices. The impact of tariffs on electronics equipment, including iPhones, depend on multiple factors, such as the tariff rate, sourcing strategies, and company decisions on cost absorption. While tariffs can increase import costs, the final retail price may not reflect a one-to-one increase due to mitigating strategies by manufacturers and retailers. However, consumers should still expect some level of price increase, particularly if companies pass on a portion of the cost. Tariffs are often viewed as a double-edged sword in the context of consumer expense. While they are designed to protect domestic industries by making imported goods more expensive, they can also create a more competitive environment that may ultimately benefit consumers in certain scenarios. Tariffs can lower consumer expenses by encouraging domestic production. By imposing tariffs on imported goods, domestic products become relatively cheaper in comparison. This can encourage consumers to purchase locally produced items, which may lead to lower prices in the long run as domestic factories grow and become more competitive. As domestic companies expand, they may achieve economies of scale, potentially lowering production costs and, consequentially, retail prices for consumers. Tariffs can level the playing field for domestic manufacturers, allowing them to compete more effectively against foreign imports. This increased competition can drive innovation and efficiency within domestic industries, leading to better products and potentially lower prices for consumers. When domestic companies are able to compete effectively, they may offer more attractive pricing to capture market share. In some cases, tariffs can stimulate the growth of new industries by protecting them from foreign competition. This can lead to a diversification of products available in the market, which may provide consumers with more choices and better prices as competition increases. While there are potential benefits, it is essential to recognize that tariffs can also lead to higher prices for consumers in the short term. The immediate effect of tariffs is often an increase in the cost of imported goods, which can be passed on to consumers. This can create a challenging economic environment, particularly if domestic industries are not able to meet demand or if they do not become more efficient quickly enough. Moreover, the long-term effectiveness of tariffs in lowering consumer expenses depends on various factors, including the responsiveness of domestic industries and the overall economic landscape. If companies do not adapt or if they choose to maintain higher prices despite reduced competition, consumers may not see the anticipated benefits. While tariffs can lead to higher prices for imported goods initially, they also have the potential to lower consumer expenses over time by fostering a more competitive domestic market. The balance between protecting local industries and ensuring affordable prices for consumers is delicate and requires careful consideration of the broader economic implications. Negative trend in solar panel performance. Findings from the Fraunhofer Institute show that many solar panels aren't delivering the power they promise. According to a summary from the Institute on Tech Explore, research from Germany's respected Fraunhofer Institute for Solar Energy System reveals that many PV modules are underperforming compared to manufacturer claims. PV stands for photovoltaic modules, also known as solar modules or PV modules. They are devices that gather energy from the sun and convert it into electrical power. Researchers found after analyzing over 70,000 solar panel measurements taken since 2012, before 2016, solar panels typically met or exceeded power ratings. Since then, actual performance has increasingly fallen below advertised levels, with 2023 showing panels underperforming by an average of 1.3%. Since then, the data has shown a negative trend. This culminated in a negative deviation between the manufacturer's specifications of about 1.3%. If you're installing solar, you might be getting less power than you paid for. The findings also make it clear how important a reliable, continuous, and independent infrastructure is for the quality control of PV modules. This research underscores why independent testing matters, particularly as more people turn to solar to lower their electricity costs and reduce air pollution. With solar installations booming worldwide, honest power ratings are needed so consumers can choose wisely. For now, if you're shopping for solar panels, consider that the advertised wattage might be optimistic. Look for manufacturers with strong reputations and seek independent and performance verification to ensure you get the clean energy output you're paying for. When you're doing your research for this sustainable energy source, it's important to factor in how long solar panels typically last. The industry standard for most solar panels' lifespan is 25 to 30 years. Most reputable manufacturers offer production warranties for 25 years or more. The average break-even point for solar panel energy savings occur 6 to 10 years after installation. If the panels continue to produce at a high level for another 15 years after that, you will end up saving thousands of dollars during the solar panel's lifespan. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
Marty Winston joins me now. And Marty, what do you have for us this week?
Yes, Ben. Oh, well, music. Do you like music?
I love music.
You won't if I do it.
Well, likewise, you know, I mix sound, but I would never, ever deign to get up in front of anybody and play any instrument whatsoever.
Oh, no, but really, that's a skill set that you may want to develop. if you want to empty your room very quickly,
yes,
perform and be bad.
Hey, folks, you know what? It's time to leave. And as a special gift for you, I will play the acoustic guitar for the next 3 minutes.
That's wonderful.
Send them all running.
Or do Tiny Tim.
Oh, man.
Early in my career.
Yeah.
You know, for me, everything is early because it's very late in my career. I did make some serious side money writing commercial jingle lyrics.
Okay, yeah.
Like anybody who remembers, come on along with ABC, we're going strong, it's you and me. I'm too glad I didn't have to sing it. That was one of 3 years we did it for the ABC Fall promo. Also, there's a celebration all across the nation. Now is the time. ABC is the place. And that one won me a Clio. So
very nice. Yeah.
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 I did some good extra revenue in those days.
And you've got a better singing voice than I do.
Well, thank you. Well, I often had to remind myself of the tune to which I was kind of Lego blocking the words.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't often near a piano.
Mm-hmm.
So I would grab one of the kids' music keyboard toys or sometimes a flutophone.
What's a flutophone?
It was used, pardon me, I think it was always third grade.
Yeah.
The professional version is called a recorder.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. All right.
You blow in one end, it's like a tunable whistle with keys.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Then, you know, came all those CES announcements, including one from Artiphon. This is Artiphon, if you want to look them up. If you're learning music, it's kind of an amazing little company, Artiphon.
Okay.
They have a music keyboard that's much more than just a keyboard. Mm-hmm. If you or somebody you know is learning music, it's kind of fun. It can be like playing guitar or drums or piano or a synth, some other voices too.
Sure, okay.
And then you can play with the attributes like the strum or vibrato.
Yeah, okay, all right.
You can layer to add drum and bass and chords to the lead, and there's more. It's really... You plunge in, there's a lot of ways to go. This keyboard, keyboard and then some, is called Corda, Chorda.
Okay.
Corda. It's not much bigger than a long French bread.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
But it is a lot more tuneful. The Artiphon Corda is about $250.
Okay, so it's a smaller... musical instrument. It's a keyboard. It's but it's a fully standalone thing. It's not plug into the computer. Actually, these days, can it plug into the computer and MIDI interface and things like that? Okay.
Well, the MIDI is limited to some extent.
Okay.
But yeah, and you can store what you've learned and add it back in and all of that stuff. I always thought, what happened to somebody that they would invent the accordion? Here's all these reeds, each one going, and then you put the keys on them, you're doing seven at a time.
Sure, yeah. You start making parody songs and change your name to Weird Al.
That could work.
That's, you know, yes.
In fact, you may not know this, but in an era before Weird Al,
yeah,
there was a Cleveland area polka band, Frankie Yankovic.
Yes.
Sometimes called Frankie Yankovic and the Yankees.
Yes, yes, yes.
With big hit tunes like Who Stole the Kishka?
Okay. I don't even know what a Kishka is, but it still sounds interesting. Was that his dad?
I don't believe they're related at all, or if they are, it's distantly.
So I know his dad was also a professional polka player.
Weird Al was. Boy, that would be a weird coincidence if they're not related.
Yeah, well, I don't know how popular the name is or anything like that. But yeah, we actually went to a Weird Al concert back a number of years ago, my wife, myself, and my son, and it was about a week after his dad passed away. And we were wondering, how's this going to play out? And he did an amazing set, got to where you would normally do the fake ending.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of the fake ending, he pulled up a stool and he talked for about 10 minutes about the impact that his dad had on his life, on his music, and all of that.
That's
fabulous. And then didn't do the fake ending, went straight into the typical encore. And it was absolutely an amazing concert.
I have the most enormous respect for Al Yankovic.
Yeah.
The music is tip of the iceberg of what we hear.
Yeah.
The things he's doing, fabulous.
Definitely. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, April the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is nyacc.org. Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, April the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is limac.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, April the 24th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is bcug.com. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, May 2nd. Meeting time is 8 p.m., online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. Tech Ed Connect meets Tuesday, May the 6th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. It's a hybrid meeting. Meeting at the Scarsdale Public Library, located at 54 Olmsted Road, Scarsdale, New York, and online virtual meeting via Zoom. And their website is techedconnect.org. Kingsbite Computer Club meets Tuesday, May the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Park Plaza Restaurant at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. And for more information, the telephone number is 347-278-7320. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.